So thanks to the New South Wales Minerals Council who helped set this up tonight, and thanks to our speaker who I will introduce briefly. Dr. Nikki Williams is a director of the Australian Coal Association. She's been involved in the issue of climate change since around 1989, and she's worked with the United Nations and with international organisations, and did so in the lead up to the Rio Earth Summit and since then. And of course she's currently the CEO of the New South Wales Minerals Council, and her topic tonight is coal and climate change, how we can have our cake and eat it too. And our speaker will speak for about 30 minutes and then we'll take questions and discussion and we'll conclude no later than 7 o'clock. Dr. Williams, you're welcome.
Thanks very much, Gerard. Oscar Wilde once said that an idea that isn't dangerous is hardly worth having, and that greatly appeals to me, so hopefully I'm going to have a few dangerous ideas tonight. A personal philosophy I have is that there is no such thing as truth, there are only facts from a perspective. So I'm also planning on introducing a number of perspectives to this very important area that we're dealing with. If any of you were expecting me to give a predictable talk on the New South Wales coal industry's response to the emissions trading scheme, the ETS, Green Paper, or Professor Garnaut's report, I think you're going to be sadly disappointed. What I am going to discuss, however, is emissions trading and the coal industry in the context both of Australian and global politics and economics. And I'm going to discuss the European Union's carbon trading scheme, probably the biggest carve-out in history, a perfect embodiment of the national interest sold as global leadership in the name of a climate change response. I'm going to talk about this as one of the biggest cons in modern times and the rorts and the market distortions that it has led to in the name of worthy environmentalism. Unlike the hype promulgated by the European Commission, Professor Garnaut's proposals represent an economic purist response to changing the world as we know it in order to avert unmanageable climate change impacts. The Rudd government's Green Paper proposals, on the other hand, of course, have been criticised for failing to go far enough. There's been much talk about freebies for our largest polluters, dismay over the petrol excise rebate, which Guy Pearce described as a procrastination subsidy, and the exclusion of agriculture and forestry until at least 2015. Bernard Keane wrote in Crikey last week that, and I quote him, "When you see the decisions, they're about as tough as custard." I don't share this view. I want to explain to you some of the political realities and major economic impacts of the Rudd government's proposed carbon pollution reduction measures. The Green Paper may not be an economic purist's dream, but despite its populist elements, it most definitely does not put populism above real change in our consuming behaviour, our quality of life, or the values that as Australians we take for granted. Its potential economic and social impacts are so great, so real, and so far in advance of anything actually contemplated in the European emissions trading scheme that it is, in fact, positively breathtaking. Given that Australian industry and thus jobs are highly trade exposed, and given that we as a country contribute less than 1.5% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, if we go with some of the key federal government proposals without other major greenhouse gas emitters and trading partners playing by the same rules at the same time, Australia is likely to face economic dislocation on a major scale. And sadly, all that pain will not even make a momentary contribution to solving climate change. So that means that I'm also going to have to talk about leadership and what Australia's options are, given the genuine desire of the federal government and the Australian people to seriously address climate change and to make a real difference. And finally, I'm going to suggest that Australia is very well positioned to have its cake and eat it too, and I'm going to keep that best bit till last. Now, if it's not animal or vegetable, it's mineral. Australia did not grow on the back of the sheep. It grew, as Quentin Dempster once remarked, on the coal conveyor belt. Indeed, as David Burchell wrote recently in The Australian, and I quote him, most modern economies, even America, were born vegetable, so to speak, and turned mineral later on. We, meaning Australia, were born mineral and have had mineral in our nation's veins ever since. It was coal that destroyed the traditional organic economy. With the development of a minerals-based economy, the productivity of agriculture was transformed. Local markets turned into national and international ones through the marvels of the steam train. Coal-powered industry dramatically reduced the cost of life's essentials, turned the luxuries of one generation into the necessities of the next. The cold hard facts of the matter are that coal is the dominant source of electricity, or dominant source of fuel for electricity in the world. And it holds that place for some very good reasons. The fact that it's available from over 100 countries globally means that it's not only highly price competitive, its diverse geography provides security of supply to consuming nations. And that's no trivial point in an era of peak oil, and where 70% of the world's oil and gas reserves are located in the Middle East and Russia. Furthermore, I mean, as the World Bank points out, electrification is inextricably linked to the alleviation of poverty. So when you consider the increasing demand for power from developing nations, married with the desire of the 2 billion people on the planet that still don't have access to a humble electric light bulb, married with their desire to actually, of course, improve their overall existence, to rise above subsistence, it's easy to see why the International Energy Agency predicts that net global electricity consumption will more than double between now and 2030, leading to a growth in CO2 emissions of 55% over that same period. Now, more than 70% of that growth will be in the two emerging powerhouse economies of China and India. China is, in fact, now the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases. And of the 800 coal-fired power stations that are going to be built around the world in the next 10 years, 500 will be built in China alone. Think about the fact also that there are 1.3 billion people living in China, and more than 800 million of them are not connected to the electricity grid. If we don't have a solution to coal use in China, we simply do not have a solution to climate change. And for the purposes of further context, while CO2 emissions from the world's coal-fired power stations represent approximately 30% of global CO2, 20% of CO2 emissions come from deforestation, 15% from transport and aviation, around 10% from households, and the rest from agriculture and other industry. And furthermore, there are in fact an array of greenhouse gases, and virtually all of them are much more radiatively potent than CO2. They also tend to have much longer residence times in the atmosphere. Methane, from the burning of natural gas, for example, from burping cows, and from rice paddy agriculture, is just one example of such greenhouse gas. Now, as I said earlier, I mean, our current quality of life is intimately related to the mining industry. Those minerals generate the electricity that enables us to build our homes, to heat and cool them, to prepare and preserve food, run our offices, our businesses, our industries, to fabricate and use all of our toys. I mean, plasma TVs and mobiles and stereos and iPods and PCs all need electricity to run. And they all require minerals, lead, zinc, aluminium, copper, alloys, etc. I mean, the list is endless, in order to construct them. So when we're talking about an emissions trading scheme to reduce our greenhouse gas footprint, we're actually talking about radical changes to those very industrial sectors that I've just mentioned. Major structural change to our economy, and the jobs not only of the 1.1 million Australians who currently work in energy-intensive industry, but indeed the jobs of all Australians. We're talking about much more expensive supply chains, food production, warehousing, distribution, retailing, the costs of our holidays, inflation rates, what we can afford to consume, what we consider a luxury or a necessity. We're talking about radical changes to the way we live our lives and how we define the quality of those lives. At least, we're starting to have that kind of conversation here in Australia. The same, however, cannot be said of Europe, which, ironically, has long touted its mantle of moral hegemony and global leadership because it was, in fact, the first to introduce a carbon emissions trading scheme. Let's take a closer look. The scheme began in 2005, with the second phase of that scheme commencing this year and the third planned for 2013. Like the proposed Australian scheme, it's a cap and trade. The cap is the amount of pollution which is allowed to be emitted, and the trade is the buying or selling of permits, depending on whether the operation is above or below its emission cap. Elegant. Except that carbon emissions in Europe are not going down. According to Kevin Smith in an article a year or so ago, industries also are not switching to new forms of energy, and countries which have introduced renewable or increased nuclear power generation have actually simply met their increased energy demand. They have not decreased demand for energy in those countries. Furthermore, and necessarily, renewable sources of energies have been introduced only with gargantuan public subsidies, $6 billion a year in Germany alone. So these things do not come without a cost. The industries that were included in the European Union's first phase were limited to energy generation, iron and steel, glass and cement, pulp, paper and board. Their permits to pollute were provided free, and they were given more permits than their total greenhouse gas emissions. In the first year of operation, the affected European industries emitted 66 million tonnes of CO2 less than they were allocated. So the carbon cap was a complete fiction. In 2006, 93% of the 10,000 sites or installations, as the Europeans call it, involved in the emissions trading scheme in Europe, still emitted less than their carbon quota, to the order of 30 million tonnes. So there were a lot of free permits that those industries could trade in the marketplace, and they did. The carbon cap was, in fact, a licence to print money. The German Environment Minister, for example, stated that the four largest German power companies made somewhere between 14.4 and 19.2 billion dollars profit in the first year of the carbon trading scheme out of those free permits. These industries also on-charged consumers the imaginary cost of the permits. And a UPS investment study concluded that this added 2.1 Australian cents a kilowatt hour to the price of electricity for the consumer. Now, even the EU, in a press release in June of this year, has had to acknowledge, in suitably hedged terms, that things have gone rather wrong. The release stated that the environmental benefit of the first phase may be limited due to excessive allocation of allowances in some member states and some sectors, due mainly to a reliance on emission projections before verified data became available. Did you know that what some apologists describe as design faults are in fact strategically calculated tools for protecting the national interest of individual EU members and the Union as a trading bloc? For example, in this second phase of the scheme, auctioning of some permits is encouraged, but only 10 of the 26 countries within the European Union have selected this option, and four of those 10 will auction less than 1% of their total allocations. Now, ironically, especially as the coal industry is a major constituent of the New South Wales Minerals Council, a Cambridge professor, Dr. Carsten Nierhoff, has stated that, and I quote him, "The level of such subsidies under proposed second phase national allocation plans is so high that the construction of coal-fired power stations is more profitable under the emissions trading scheme in Europe than in the absence of the emissions trading scheme." Stunningly, whilst the EU will now introduce European-wide rules to control some of those excesses, what it describes as the comitology process, it's stated, and again I quote, taking into account their ability to pass on the increased cost of emission allowances, full auctioning should be the rule from 2013 for the power sector. In other sectors, allocations for free will be phased out progressively, resulting in no free allocation in 2020. However, an exception will be made for installations in sectors judged to be at a significant risk of carbon leakage, meaning that they could be forced by international competitive pressures to relocate production to countries outside the European Union that did not impose comparable constraints on emissions. Now, I'm still quoting directly from the European Commission here. This would simply increase global emissions without any environmental benefit. Well, I couldn't have said it any better myself. But the Commission goes on further in terms of protecting its national interest by saying that installations in internationally competitive sectors will still receive up to 100% of their allowances for free for good. Now, the Rudd government has been much more honest and a lot less generous in its proposals. Australia's planned scheme has more ambitious targets, covers more sectors, has a stricter permit allocation system, and what's more, will be developed and implemented far more quickly than the European system. Under the European Emissions Trading Scheme, there will be no full auctioning of permits until 2020, and even then, as I've said, trade-exposed sectors will get up to 100% of their permits free. In 2013, only the power sector will be subject to full auctioning. Industries outside the power sector will still receive up to 80% of their permits free, and this 80% is apparently going to be phased down over the period to 2020, although conveniently there's no detail on the rate of such a phase down. In contrast to this measured approach, the Rudd government wants to go in guns blazing, with full auctioning from the start of our scheme on the 1st of July 2010. The EU scheme currently covers only 40% of emissions. This will expand to 60% by 2013, but will not cover transport, except probably aviation, housing, agriculture, or the waste sectors. Here in Australia, the Rudd government proposes to cover 70% of emissions from July 1, 2010. In the first and second phase of the European scheme, the only greenhouse gas covered was carbon dioxide. From 2013, the European Union scheme will cover 5 of the 6 greenhouse gases under the Kyoto Protocol. So this means that even in 2013, methane, which represents 20% of emissions in Australia, for example, is still not going to be covered by the European Union. The Rudd government proposes to cover all 6 greenhouse gases, including methane, from day one of our scheme. Now, I guess Professor Garnaut is even further out there. He's argued for no compensation for electricity generators, and I think that this has very serious energy security risks for Australia. Professor Garnaut has also, I think, a somewhat optimistic view of international negotiations. He suggests that given the difficulties of reaching a comprehensive global agreement on emissions reductions in the near future, Australia could reach sectoral agreement in areas such as metals, liquefied natural gas, cement and sheep and cattle products with our major international competitors as an interim measure. He seems to propose that interim could be as early as 2012. This optimism obviously ignores the protectionist history of nation states, such as Europe's defence of its agriculture sector, Japan's defence of its rice sector, and the fact that governments are predicated on protecting the national interest. The European Union has also introduced something called the Clean Development Mechanism, CDM. Sorry about the acronyms. This allows operations in Europe to invest in emission-saving projects overseas to compensate for their emissions within the EU. Apparently not a bad scheme, because, of course, climate change doesn't recognise national boundaries, nor does it differentiate between those working to combat it and those choosing to ignore it. There is a big but, however. In Kevin Smith's article, Emissions Trading in the EU, Leaky Caps and Dirty Development, he reveals the following. The CDM is framed in very benevolent democratic rhetoric. The projects are supposed to bring developmental benefits to local communities and to create incentives for investments in low carbon energy infrastructure. But almost two-thirds of the 1,534 CDM projects in the pipeline have not involved either the generation of clean energy or CO2 emission reductions. In fact, 30% of CDM credits have been generated from the destruction of HFC-23, which is a greenhouse gas created by the manufacture of refrigerant gases. Now, if you read Nature magazine, you would discover that the value of these credits for the destruction of this particular refrigerant gas, the value of that of those credits was $11.3 billion, twice the cost of the gases themselves. Interestingly, the cost to actually capture and destroy the gases was only around $240 million. So that works out, and I'm pretty primitive on my maths, but I'm pretty sure I'm right, that works out as more than an $11 billion profit for the manufacturers of these refrigerant gases and the project brokers. Now, I'd assume you'd have to agree with me, ladies and gentlemen, when I say that this can only be described as a rort, not the intention of the policy, but most definitely a rort. Now, if I lacked ethics and was only driven by the dollar, I might reinvest some of that $11 billion, build another manufacturing site, and go through the whole process again. That could double my money. Do you know how the European Union has actually met its greenhouse gas reduction target? Firstly, they closed down East Germany. Secondly, the other restructured economies of the former Warsaw Pact countries are nowadays mere blips on the industrial production and consumption radar. But their original, much higher emissions form part of the EU's emission numbers. So, and finally, Britain has burned 40 years of natural gas in just 8. Those measures have allowed the European Union as a whole to meet Kyoto. In every other instance, every major economy, Denmark, Norway, they have all exceeded their Kyoto targets. Now, I wonder whether the Greens Party in Australia would be so keen to laud the Europeans if it was apprised of these inconvenient truths, or facts, as I prefer to call them. But then again, as my friend Bernard Keane has written, the Greens, one suspects, don't care much about what the rest of the world does and wants Australia to plunge into serious and deep emissions cuts that would have major economic consequences. No policy or political blame attaches to the government for failing to run with the Greens' agenda in the absence of international action. And this point is absolutely fundamental. The European Commission and every other developed country in the world recognises that going solo is not an act of leadership. It's an act contrary to the national interest. And vitally, going solo, even if you were a major greenhouse gas emitter, which Australia is not, would not materially contribute to climate change solutions because of that concept of carbon leakage that I referred to before, a very trendy term, basically to describe the movement offshore of emissions-intensive production facilities from one country to another, and that results in no net global emissions reductions. On the other hand, if a large number of emitters play by the same rules of a carbon market and all their economies endure equivalent pain, then we're all still going to have economic and social pain. But we face the prospect of actually reducing at least the growth of greenhouse gas emissions. If the emerging economies finally joined that carbon reduction club, then we might actually go somewhere near to the 60% cut in emissions by the year 2050 that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says are absolutely necessary to avert catastrophic climate change impacts. Now, if we were to follow Dr. Tim Flannery's logic, we would conclude that Professor Garnaut's model, the economic purist version, would represent a risk to our economy, but that the risk of inaction was even higher and most certainly morally unconscionable. Dr. Flannery stated in The Age earlier this month that the issue of climate change and growing emissions in the newly emerging economies, and I quote, is so complex yet so urgent that we have no choice but to learn on the job. Now, the EU, I guess, could be said to have learned on the job, but at no cost to its economic growth, to the quality of life or employment in the European Union. Dr. Flannery is most definitely right to point to the enormous complexity of climate change, energy use and its link to economic growth and the structure of emissions trading systems, but I don't believe he's right to say we should suck it and see. No responsible parent, for example, would allow a toddler near the sort of toxic chemicals that we keep in our bathrooms and kitchens and garden sheds, right? Because learning on the job in that case could be fatal. Trying to strike a realistic balance when introducing an economic change of this order of magnitude is a Herculean task. The Rudd government has tried to strike a politically and socially acceptable balance, hugely controversial though it is. And I certainly wouldn't want Senator Wong or Prime Minister Rudd's job for anything. It's always, in fact, much harder, no matter what your electoral mandate, when you sit on the actual data, when you know that your decisions will actually materially affect the citizens of your country and prejudicially affect those citizens. In 1998, then Vice President Al Gore signed the Kyoto Protocol. The US Senate voted unanimously on a resolution which said that the US should not commit economic suicide. I mean, it didn't use those terms literally, by being a signatory to a protocol that contained neither binding targets for emissions reductions nor timetables to match for both industrialised and industrialising countries. Vice President Gore promised at the time that the protocol wouldn't be ratified or acted upon until the developing world agreed to join it. As we know, neither the Clinton nor Bush administrations ratified Kyoto. And that's not to say that Al Gore is not seriously worried about climate change or that his arguments lack merit. An inconvenient truth was and is compelling. But the social justice and political realities were not lost to Al Gore when he was in a position to effect actual change rather than, as now, raise international awareness about the nature and magnitude of the problem the world faces. The realities are not lost on Professor Garnaut and the architects of the federal government's proposed scheme either. That's why full compensation for lower income Australians is being mooted. That's why transitional arrangements are speculated on. That's why not all sectors have been proposed for inclusion at the commencement of the scheme. A major concern is the limited discussion in the Green Paper on investment in vital new low emission technologies. Large investment is urgently needed in research, development, and most importantly, commercialisation of those low-emission technologies. And whilst the New South Wales Minerals Council has long advocated the need for a suite of technology solutions, including advanced renewables, one such technology closely linked, of course, to coal-fired power generation deserves very specific attention. Carbon capture and storage technology, CCS, another acronym, is the only technology that can significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel production. CCS technologies could contribute up to 55% of global cumulative mitigation. And experts such as the International Energy Agency, Sir Nicholas Stern, Al Gore, Professor Ross Garnaut, all agree that the response to climate change must include the deployment of carbon capture and storage. Even Tim Flannery and Bob Brown, who certainly could not be said to be friends of the mining industry, acknowledge the potential role of carbon capture and storage in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The commercialisation of carbon capture and storage, of course, will need money, and lots of it. As Anthony White from Climate Change Capital, which is an investment bank focused on low carbon emissions, says, the renewable industry, and he's referring to the renewable industry in Europe, has had billions spent on it, and technologies like wind power are now becoming mature. carbon capture and storage hasn't had its billions yet. While the Green Paper, the Australian Government's Green Paper on the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, acknowledges that as a major coal exporter, Australia needs to support the development of carbon capture and storage technology, it is strangely silent, very silent, on the very important subject of investment dollars. In contrast, Professor Ross Garneau demonstrates, I think, a better understanding of the technology imperative and what's needed to achieve it. He recommends that by 2013, Australia should commit $3 billion a year to research, development and commercialisation of low-emission technologies. These figures are the bare minimum needed. We need to think of the commercialisation of carbon capture and storage as a nation-building exercise. This technology, indeed, will be the snowy hydro for a carbon-constrained world. Finally, given that the Rudd government is intent on fulfilling its election commitment to commence the emissions trading scheme by July 2010, it's imperative that the details of the scheme are released as soon as possible. Business is waiting for leadership that moves beyond doorstop interviews and lunchtime addresses and into the very unsexy detail of a comprehensive climate change policy framework. This includes the scale of interim emissions targets, in particular the medium-term 2020 target range, and details on assistance for industry and households. These details will allow business to respond by making an assessment of the costs, the returns, the risks, and importantly, to plan for the scheme consequences so that economic effects can be better managed. The absence of the data and the rules at the start of the European Union scheme largely accounted for the flawed nature of its carbon trading scheme. If people don't know the rules, they can panic. Without certainty, people can't make rational decisions, and particularly given a full auctioning system, which is what is being proposed here in Australia, there could be huge wealth transfers and other market failures when the Australian scheme commences. So it comes down to this. We can have a scheme in 2010, or we can have the right scheme in 2012 or 2013. In its current form, the carbon pollution reduction scheme of the federal government becomes an industry reduction scheme. No society that I'm aware of ever willingly reduced its standard of living. No government has ever been elected on a mandate to kill an economy, although a few have come fairly close to giving that a good go. Even dictatorships get uncomfortable when people start rioting over food shortages or fuel price increases. And democracies are at least, if not more, sensitive to such popular reactions, given that losing power at the next election is inevitable in those circumstances. Australia needs to be very, very careful. There's no silver bullet solution to climate change, but we can make a material difference. Practical answers are called for, and these involve a whole suite of technical solutions, ranging from low and zero emission coal technologies, advanced renewables, demand management, nuclear power, energy efficient buildings, energy efficient appliances, and better industrial processes. A hamburger with the lot. And practical solutions, very practical solutions, are exactly what the Australian coal industry sought to generate when it created the Coal 21 Initiative, which is, in fact, a world-first voluntary industry levy and partnership between coal producers, state and federal governments, electricity generators, and very importantly, the research community, such as CRCs and the CSIRO, and electricity generators, I think, as I said. Now, perhaps typically of our industry, Coal 21 was launched without a lot of fanfare, but with a lot of passion, a lot of professionalism, a lot of scientific collaboration, and a lot of dollars. $1 billion to demonstrate low-emission technologies. Now, this was well before that climate change became a mainstream issue in Australia, before Al Gore's film, before the Stern Report. The Coal 21 Fund also leverages several billion dollars more in funding that has been committed by governments and individual companies towards this vitally important development and deployment effort. Now, I hear the reaction from some people that this is not enough, it's too little, it's too late, and some claim that it's merely PR. If it is PR, it'd have to rate as the most expensive PR campaign in Australian history. In Australia, 8 demonstration projects are either committed or underway where carbon capture and storage will play a vital role in the pilot, including the CO2 CRC storage project in the Otway Basin in Victoria, the Gorgon natural gas project in Western Australia, and an integrated dry and gasification combined cycle plant by HRL, also in Victoria. So there are 3 of them. The CSIRO's post-combustion capture project in New South Wales is also interesting because it involves retrofitting an existing coal-fired power station with a mobile capture unit. And retrofitting technologies will be key to delivering the 60% cuts in CO2 that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says we must achieve, because many trillions of dollars are already invested in existing power stations all around the world, the useful life of which, in many cases, exceeds 30 years. It's also very exciting to hear this month that the CSIRO and China's largest electricity producer, the Huaneng Group, have jointly launched a post-combustion capture pilot capable of recovering more than 85% of the CO2 from the flue gases from the power station at a power station in China. And this is a breakthrough not only for China, but indeed for the rest of the world. And it shows that countries all around the world are starting to move on technology. Australia can and is making a difference, but I think we have to be quick to keep up with global developments. Countries like the Netherlands announced in April this year a multi-billion dollar commitment to coal-fired power generation and to becoming a European hub for carbon capture and storage technology. They have also said no to any further nuclear. World authorities like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Nicola Stern, Al Gore, all recognise how significant this technology will be in coming years. But opponents, of course, of the coal industry continue to claim that carbon capture and storage is either a fiction or a major problem in itself. Now, at the Sleipner project in Norway, 1 million tonnes of carbon dioxide has been captured and is being stored 1,000 metres beneath the seabed each and every year since 1996. Over 2,000 tonnes of CO2 is separated from Sleipner's gas production each day and is injected into the Utsira aquifer. Now, this aquifer, this formation, is in fact large enough to store all of Europe's 600 billion tonnes of CO2 emissions for the next 600 years. Now, since 2000, when monitoring of the CO2 started, there's been zero leakage. And the Norwegian government and the scientists that support this project estimate that the CO2 will remain in situ, in the ground, in the Utsira aquifer, until at least the next ice age, which apparently is 5 to 10,000 years away. There are at least 20 other projects of this type up and running or in development across Europe, in Algeria, India, China, and North America. The technology is proven not by virtue of these demonstration projects, but because the oil and gas industries have actually been using it for well over 20 years as part of enhanced oil recovery techniques. Now, these examples of the pioneering work being done explain why Al Gore has said, and I quote, "Carbon capture and storage will play a significant and growing role as one of the major building blocks of the solution to the climate crisis." International energy experts clearly state that low-emission coal technology will definitely be part of the mix in the response to climate change. As Sir Nicholas Stern states, even after deep emissions cuts, fossil fuels will still account for 55% of global energy supply. And I quote him, "Extensive carbon capture and storage will allow this continued use of fossil fuels without damage to the atmosphere." Now, Jeffrey Sachs, a professor of sustainable development at Columbia University and special advisor to the UN Secretary-General, Ban Ki-moon, says that Australia, as a major coal-using country, should concentrate on carbon capture and storage at coal-fired power plants as its number one strategy, even more important, in his view, than a carbon trading scheme or any kind of tax. Now, Sachs argues that this approach would not only allow Australia to manage a relatively low-cost transition to a low-emission future, but put it, of course, in a very good position to market those technologies to China, to India, and other major coal consumers around the world. Sachs made the important observation that the biggest question for Australia is not to decide what kind of emissions trading scheme we want, but what kind of energy future we want. And once we've decided that, we can more easily work on the policies and strategies to best reach our goal. So in terms of Australia's reliance on coal, is it a case that the party's over, or can we have our cake and eat it too? Dr. Martin Luther King once said that we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Climate change does not differentiate, or greenhouse gas emissions don't differentiate between or reward those that act with an eye to politics above environmental values, or those that define leadership as going solo or introducing economic pain now for the sake of future benefit. Even a massive contribution towards fighting and controlling the impacts of climate change by a major greenhouse gas emitter, if not complemented by equivalent action amongst other major emitters, will not receive a gold star or a big tick from the world's climate, or posthumous praise and recognition from the world's future citizens. Investing in carbon capture and storage and fast-tracking its deployment in Australia, if adopted on a major scale globally, could, on the other hand, materially and positively affect climate change outcomes. Going it alone with an emissions trading scheme, a carbon pollution reduction scheme, or any other uncalibrated, unprecedented economic dislocation by a country which emits just over 1% of the world's greenhouse gases is certainly not going to be a solution to climate change. A new Australian Prime Minister was elected in part on a climate change mandate. High symbolism was captured with the signing of the Kyoto Protocol, and many Australians breathed a great sigh of relief that the country was seemingly on a path to environmental redemption and political decoupling from the Bush administration's climate change inaction. Most members of the general public in the developed world haven't yet made the vital link between climate change responses and what that will mean for them personally and the society of which they are a member. As a generalisation, many members of the Australian public believed until just a few weeks ago that all that was left to be done, now that Kyoto was signed and a government was installed that was committed to being publicly part of the climate change solution, was for industry, and most especially the coal industry, to finally pay up and fix the problem. However confused people might be now, a small realisation is dawning that what industry paying up actually means is that all Australians are going to suffer economic and social consequences pretty much immediately when business responds to government policy and starts to fix the problem. Australia's cake is carbon capture and storage. Global deployment of carbon capture and storage is how we all get to eat our cake as well. Thank you.
And so we come to question and discussion. There are a lot of things here, so if you keep your question or your comment short, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. We've got some microphones here, and I should say thanks to Lancia Jordan and the Minerals Council for helping setting this function up tonight. Can I just lead off the Minerals Council here? Do you feel you can put a submission through by September, or do you feel you've got to await the Treasury figuring by October?
Clearly, there are principles that.
Talk to the back of the room.
Okay. There are clearly principles which the industry believes an emissions trading scheme should encompass, and submissions can be made in relation to those principles. Clearly, it is also the case that we need the data, the hard economic data, to actually work out what the impacts are. So I think it's going to be a phased approach in terms of our response to that paper necessarily. And it's important to note that the federal government has put out a series of proposals. I mean, this is precisely to invite commentary back from different sectors of the of Australian society and our industrial sectors to determine what's likely to work. And we will refine that as once we understand much more about the economic modelling. The fact that the modelling has not been provided with the Green Paper is indicative of how complex it is to achieve.
There's a question here.
I have two questions.
No, just hang on one second. Let's go with one question. Okay, here's a question. Come in here.
What is a realistic time frame for getting this scheme that you're talking about in terms of, because obviously it isn't, we don't have the solution yet, but what's a realistic framework? And just a quick thing about Germany, which you mentioned, are they actually at a 50% reduction at, or 50% point in their reduction of fossil fuels?
I'm not absolutely certainly. Germany is actually the world's seventh largest consumer of coal, fourth largest producer of coal, but it has made a very heavy investment in renewable technologies, and it has certainly cut its emissions. I'm not certain of the percentage of which it's been cut, but it has achieved that. But as I indicated in the paper, it has done so at a cost to the economy of $6 billion a year in subsidies. What's very important to understand, and I'll come back to your first question in a moment, what's very important to understand when we're talking about the European Union, for example, compared to Australia, is that the average cost of electricity in Europe is three times higher than we enjoy in Australia. Our major trading partners and, indeed, competitors, particularly in Asia, are enjoying electricity prices similar to the ones we enjoy there. So you have a huge difference. You've already got Europeans used to a very different economic model. Their entire economy is premised on a much higher cost of electricity than our economy is premised on. So, you at a $50 a tonne carbon cost, for example, you've got a trebling of our electricity price. So, that's a serious issue, and it's not just a serious issue for us as consumers in our homes. It's primarily a serious issue for the economy of Australia, because 70% of our electricity is consumed by businesses and industry, and about 10% by us. So if that industry ceases to be competitive, then we have major employment implications, and that's why the cost of electricity is such a sensitive and important subject for us to deal with. In terms of the first part of your question, I assume you're talking about carbon capture and storage. The industry is of the view that it will be at commercial deployment between 2017 and 2020. We are also of the view that it is vitally important that we don't have the luxury of time in terms of the severity of the problem of climate change. So the more money that is invested in the rapid deployment of carbon capture technology along with a suite of other technological options, the quicker we're going to be able to at first stem the growth in our greenhouse gas emissions, and ultimately, once that technology is being deployed in countries like China, the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter, we then have the opportunity potentially to start reducing the emissions. But that is going to require global participation. We could commit harikiri, we could turn off Australia, turn off the coal industry, turn off the lights, leave the country, and in 6 months, the growth in China's greenhouse gas emissions would replace Australia's entire greenhouse gas emissions. So we have to understand it in context.
Question there. Yep. Well, let's start without the microphone.
Nick Egan, Dunlop. Thanks for your talk. I take it from what you said, you treat climate change as being serious.
Absolutely.
The thing I found missing in the discussion and your talk is the urgency of what we're now facing. The targets that have been talked about by Stern are in the 450, 550 parts per million range. Gano, the modelling, is doing the same sort of thing. All of the science at the moment is suggesting that that is far too high, and we are actually going to have to escalate this and accelerate the whole process much more rapidly. I have no problem with the concept of carbon capture and storage. I think we're a bit optimistic about the history of things like Sleipner and other history in the oil industry. It seems to me the research has to continue, and we certainly need to be following that through. But I have a problem with the way in which we seem to be trying to put all our eggs in one basket in terms of this being the ultimate panacea for the problem.
Ian, I've got to cut it sometime.
Okay, so you're saying that effectively it will come in commercially by 2020. That would be great. But in the meantime, if you look at the IEA figures, we're effectively pushing the world into carbon atmospheric concentrations probably way up at 500 plus. Purely by what's going to happen and get locked in by then. So how do you propose that we address this?
As I said, Ian.
Because the world has changed since...
Ian, we have one speaker here tonight. Can we have a brief response? Because a lot of people... Yeah.
As I said, Ian, there's a whole suite of answers. There's a hamburger with a lot. There's low-hanging fruit that we need to address, not only in this country, but indeed specifically in the developed world more generally, energy efficiency. When is the federal government... I mean, for example, the largest owner of cars in this country... our governments, the fleet, the government fleet. So when are we going to ban the six-cylinder car? That would make a major, immediate, easy-peasy reduction in our emissions and air pollution more generally. So there's a lot of things like those which must happen now, energy efficiency standards, etc., and I did refer to those in the paper. Carbon capture and storage is essential for the long term, whether we're at 400 parts, 500 parts, 650 parts per million of gases, for the simple reason that even with cuts, fossil fuels and particularly coal will still account for more than 50% of the world's electricity in the next 20 years. We don't use carbon capture and storage. We simply have no opportunity to control the single largest stationary source of CO2 emissions.
Okay, there's a question up there. Yep.
Nikki, Steve Boll, and does the council hold a view on the economics and the efficacy of underground coal gasification, and on top of that, I suppose, gas to liquids technology that's being developed in Australia and around the world at the moment?
Well, we don't have some sort of official policy or whatever. Obviously, individual companies and the industry as a whole is extremely supportive of different approaches to using resources and dealing with problems. I mean, we have many examples. For example, in New South Wales, we have quite a lot of methane in a number of our coal mines, and that methane needs to be extracted prior to mining for safety reasons. Now, we have some brilliant examples, world-first examples, BHP in the Illawarra, for example, where they're actually draining that methane, converting it through using interesting technology, and that's going into the grid and it's powering 60,000 homes. Now, whether it's underground gasification or any other innovative way to deal with issues, we're very interested as an industry in supporting. Obviously, they have to stack up commercially, and that's up to individual proponents to work through it.
No, I guess I mean...
Okay. We've got to go on because we've got other questions here. Okay, there's a question up here. It's got to be brief. We don't have a lot of time. Okay.
I've got a question.
Okay, just go with it, okay?
I've got a question based on a devil's advocate type paper that just came out in the New Scientist. The title is, Who Needs Coal When You Can Have Deep Heat Based on Geothermal Energy? I mean, isn't that statement a bit simplistic and ridiculous?
I mean, geothermal is obviously hot rocks, for anyone who's not familiar with the terminology, is very interesting. The biggest problem in Australia, and possibly in other locations, but I can only really comment about Australia, is that our hot rocks tend to be located a very long way from where anybody lives. So the cost of the distribution network to actually generate, to generate the electricity from the thermal energy produced by the burning rocks, heated rocks, and then distributing it to major urban centres means that the economics doesn't stack up. That won't be the case in every instance, and I think that as a society we need to be looking at lots of examples of distributed energy where it's possible to generate sufficient power from wind or solar or whatever it might be in remote locations or in less developed countries where there are substantial populations. We should be doing that. We shouldn't just be thinking conventional, large-scale power plants. But we have to be realistic. Baseload power is generated from large industrial installations and will continue until we're into the next generation of power, and I don't know what that's going to be. Hydrogen, maybe.
Yep.
Nikki, you recognise the urgency from a climate change point of view, but you advocate that emissions trading should start probably 2012, 2013. In terms of money, is therefore to be invested quickly in this urgent part of CCS, which I would agree with you. Isn't this the time that you should be advocating a windfall profits tax on your industry to look after its very survival?
Gosh, you know, I've got my chairman here. I can feel execution coming on. The thing about windfall profits, and I mean, it's clearly the case, Greg, that our industry and the oil industry and the gas industry and indeed many other sectors are going through an extraordinary phase. And the reason, one of the biggest drivers of that, is that half the world, being India and China, is currently industrialising. And that is what is generating such huge demand for our resources and indeed the resources from around the world, which is a huge part of the driver of the price, price increases, and also the fact that our economy, as many other economies, simply wasn't geared up with sufficient infrastructure to be able to deliver to that market. So there's a sort of supply constraint. The fact is, however, that the average return on capital employed in the resources sector, not, I know, in the oil business, because I used to be in the oil business, is 8%. Now, there is no bank that would risk its capital for an 8% return. If you're talking about major investments, they would be looking at a minimum of a 20% return over the life of that investment. So when you look at an average return for our industry, it's actually 8%. That might be slightly tweaked now. So the commodity sector is a cyclical sector. It's enjoying a boom. That's very important. But you need booms to pay for the times when you are losing money horrendously, closing mines and all the rest of it. You've been in the resources sector. You understand those cycles very well. Taxes, I don't think, are the way. Our industry has made a voluntary contribution. It's a very large one. Individual companies within our industry have made very large individual contributions, billions of dollars. That is the way the industry has approached it, and I suspect that that is the way that the industry will continue, and rightly so.
Well, we're right on 7, if I missed anyone. So, in conclusion, what are you actually, in a very short term, what are you going to be saying to Senator Wong, to the Prime Minister, in the lead up to 1st of July 2010?
We're certainly going to be saying there are some very interesting lessons that we need to learn from the European scheme, i.e. What are our environmental objectives and what price are we prepared to pay and how are we going to do that at the lowest possible cost to the Australian economy, and are we going to do that without equivalent intentions or understanding of intentions of our major competitors and trading partners? So these are going to be key issues that need to be dealt with. If you're asking me, are we going to respond in XYZ manner to specific proposals, obviously you'll need to wait for our submission. But in terms of principles, we will be saying that an efficient emissions trading scheme needs to achieve certain objectives, and one of those objectives is not destroying the Australian economy, and that's not the Rudd government's intention, obviously. It's not trying to do that. But it does have a political mandate. It is a serious problem. There is a clear feeling in the Australian electorate that we must take urgent action. But we must recognise that those who have taken so-called urgent action have done so in very clever ways, and I would hate to see the Australian economy devastated for the sake of an environmental outcome that devastation will not generate. In other words, we can turn off the country and we still won't solve climate change. Those matters of principle will form, obviously, a key part of our discussion with the federal government. The mechanics and responses will depend on the numbers, and that we wait to see that with eagerly.
Well, many thanks. We've had a lot of discussions on climate change. We had Malcolm Turnbull last year, Senator Wong's going to come later, Christine Milne will be here relatively soon, and there have been others as well. And thanks to Dr. Williams tonight for an important contribution and giving us a different kind of aspect into one kind of solution to what most people regard as a significant problem. So it's an important paper tonight. It'll be published in the Sydney papers. It'll be up on our pod tomorrow. But for tonight, many thanks, and we'll see you back in the future. Thank you.